Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found.
Yeah, we did. We started to burn many things we found. Too many things we found. Global warming, all that stuff. Topic of the major gathering in Paris going on right now, talking about carbon emissions, all that stuff. There are many thousands of people actually in Paris gathered. I've just been on the email with one of my favorites, Stephanie Spear, the editor-publisher of EcoWatch. She's there. And we also have just been assaulted by an utterly insane article written by Dr. James Hansen and three others saying that nuclear power should be used to solve the global warming problem. This is like trying to solve a headache by committing suicide with a bullet through your head. It's unreal. I am going to be replying to that, and we'll put a piece up at PRN and elsewhere within the next day or so. And we're going to talk a bit about that, especially focus on that in the second part of our show. Today we have the fantastic Charles Komenoff, a great advocate of the carbon tax, going to join us from New York City, a friend of mine for more years than I care to I can't even begin to count. But so we will be talking about carbon emissions, global warming, all that stuff. In the interim, we have an immediate story just broke, and break is the right word. The Ohio Public Utilities, the staff of the Ohio Public Utilities Commission has come out and advocated a settlement, so-called, with First Energy. I can't even begin to describe this thing. It gives new meaning to the word psychosis. I have two great guests. Kevin, are you there?
Yes, I am.
And Shannon, you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, so we have Kevin Camps, who's been a very frequent guest here with us in Solartopia. And Shannon, you are with the Sierra Club, I believe, yes, is that right?
Well, I'm actually an attorney with Earth Justice, and we represent the Sierra Club in the First Energy proceeding.
Okay, I'm going to ask Kevin to lead off. Since I don't want to, drive my stress levels through the roof here, Kevin, can you describe what the idiots at the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio have just recommended in relation to Davis Bessie, the nuclear plant near Toledo?
Sure, and Shannon, hi, Shannon. You can certainly correct me if I'm wrong, because you're actually, a party to the proceedings, but the agreement that was settled and now goes before the PUCO commissioners themselves for approval or disapproval is a nearly $4 billion ratepayer subsidy. And in that sense, Harvey, when you mentioned Charles Komenoff and the carbon tax coming on, in an ironic way, it's a reverse carbon tax. What it would do is it would surcharge households and businesses in Ohio on their electricity bill to prop up a number of coal plants at Samus and OVEC, O-V-E-C, on the Ohio River, to burn carbon, to burn coal, and emit it into the atmosphere. And also, it would be a reverse tax, I guess you could say, on splitting atoms at Davis Bessie. And our focus, Beyond Nuclear and Don't Waste Michigan and Citizens Environment Alliance of Southwestern Ontario and the Ohio Green Party, have been fighting the 20-year license extension at Davis Bessie for 5 years now at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And the thing that I keep harping on, I'll admit it, is that Davis Bessie has a severely cracked containment vessel. I'm sorry, a severely cracked concrete containment shield building, which is secondary containment. The primary inner steel containment vessel at Davis Bessie is also corroded. So what you've got is a containment at Davis Bessie around the atomic reactor that is severely questionable in terms of corrosion and cracking. So to conclude, the ratepayers of Ohio are being asked, at least at Davis Bessey, to subsidize another 21 years of radioactive Russian roulette.
God, you know, it's just mind-boggling to me. And Kevin, this is Kevin Camps we're talking with of the Beyond Nuclear, probably the guy who knows more about Davis Bessey than anybody outside the owners of the plant. And you wonder really how much the owners actually know. You have described in great detail the physical situation of Davis Bessey. This reactor is just outside Toledo on Lake Erie, where the shield building is actually collapsing, crumbling, pieces of concrete at this nuclear power plant falling off and threatening the machinery below. This is the nuke where boric acid ate through stainless steel. I can't even begin to if Davis Bessey was a car, you wouldn't drive it. If it was a house, you wouldn't live in it. And now, Shannon, go ahead.
Well, Kevin. Harvey, I have to correct you. The concrete hasn't begun to chunk off the exterior yet, but the risk is that if an earthquake hits that site, if a tornado drives a telephone pole into the shield building, if a terrorist attacks, or if a meltdown happens inside that shield building, the shield building is in such fragile condition that you're right, at that point, with that extra load or force, then the concrete could well crumble off. And what you, like you said, down below, you've got safety significant systems and structures and components that a heavy chunk of concrete could take out. And then you're on your way to, you know, a catastrophic radioactivity release.
And what's been happening is that the shield building, which is concrete and is exposed to the elements, is porous, right? And water gets in, and then it freezes, and then it thaws, and then it freezes, and then it thaws.
The root cause theory is that the blizzard of 1978 caused the cracking to begin with, and then ironically enough, you know, it remained hidden for 33 years until it was accidentally discovered in 2011. But then, just like the hole in the head fiasco you described from 2002, First Energy committed a self-inflicted wound yet again in October of 2012 by weather sealing the shield building 40 years too late to prevent water infiltration and prevented water locked in the walls from getting out. And so now every time it freezes at the site, the cracking grows by a half inch or more. And First Energy recently admitted that the cracking can grow by 9 inches per year.
9 inches?
Per year.
Shannon, you are an attorney. Thank you. Kevin Kantz, by the way, I have had you on the show many times and will again, of course, and I have sat through your presentation on the actual physical setup at Davis Bessey, and anybody who's not absolutely terrified by the physical condition of the nuclear reactor at Davis Bessey near Toledo is just not paying attention. And what we've had today now, or the last couple of days, is the staff of the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio making a recommendation. Shannon, can you give us your full name and your credentials and then tell us what's going on here?
Sure. So I'm Shannon Fisk. I'm a managing attorney with the COAL program at Earth Justice. We're a national environmental law firm that works to advocate for a cleaner environment. And in this case, we represent Sierra Club in challenging First Energy's proposal, which is seeking a bailout of a number of uneconomic plants that they currently own. As Kevin mentioned, a couple of them are coal plants, the Samus plant and the OVEC plants. And then they also are seeking a bailout of their Davis Bessey plant. And Tuesday, the staff of the commission and First Energy announced a backroom deal that would if it were approved by the commission, would lock customers into paying all the costs of Davis Bessie and Samus and the OPEC plants for the next 8 years, and shift all of the financial risk that those plants will not make money over the next 8 years on the customers. And independent evaluations of the economic impacts of that deal suggest that it could cost customers of FirstEnergy's affiliates up to $3.9 billion over the 8 years. And FirstEnergy's own numbers, even their own overly rosy projections, admit that in the first 31 months, customers would lose $414 million total. So it's just, it's nothing more than a bailout for some aging and expensive coal and nuclear plants that customers shouldn't be taking the risk of. It should be FirstEnergy and its shareholders that should be taking the risk. And by propping up these plants, the additional big problem is that it's crowding out what we should be doing, which is developing clean renewable power. So it's crowding out wind and solar and basically all these other clean energy sources that would be cheaper and better for customers than these old nuclear and coal plants. But what the commission, if the commission were to approve this, they would prop up those old outdated plants rather than transitioning to a better, cleaner future.
It's mind-boggling. Now, a lot of us were speculating. FirstEnergy, otherwise known as First Enema, this horrible, completely irresponsible, out-of-control corporation that is in the power business in northern Ohio, based in Akron. They stuck together this deal with two of the worst, most decrepit, most indefensible power plants in the entire world. Not only Davis Bessie, which is falling apart, probably the most dangerous, on its own, the most dangerous reactor in the world, given the fact that it could just about falling over. And they tacked it together with the Samus nuclear plant, Colbert, which is more than 50 years old, for God's sakes. Now, when they came up with this proposed deal, a lot of us thought that they just tacked on the Samus coal burner to sort of buy off the environmental movement. They were going to, like, dump Samus and just say, oh, well, you guys can have that, but we're going to get the money for the nuke. But apparently this deal proposed by the staff of the PUCO includes Samus. Is that possible?
It does. This backroom deal that has been worked out would include all of the Samus units, all seven of them, and they are, they are between 40 and 55 years old already. So it would be propping them up for another 8 years, and it would include shares of FirstEnergy's OPEC plants, and then it would also include the nuclear plant. And then I would note that the commission is also considering a proposal from American Electric Power that has another 3,100 megawatts of coal-fired power that the commission has to decide whether to prop those up also.
My God, this is just, is there any concession at all to anything even remotely green that would make this have the slightest bit of sense?
Certainly not in the backroom deal that was worked out here. There's no enforceable or real commitment to do any renewable energy, any energy efficiency of any specific amount. No enforceable plan to reduce their carbon. You know, what we've been advocating for is you have plants that are losing, that are economically challenged. And they will be losing money in the future in the marketplace. We should be figuring out a way to transition as quickly as possible away from those plants and to a cleaner, more competitive future. And the commission has the opportunity to do that here. They could, figure out a way to make that transition and make sure that, in a few years we would be working to retire Samus and bring in renewables and bring in more energy efficiency. But this backroom deal that the staff and First Energy have cut just clearly does not do that.
Kevin Camps, you want to add to that?
Well, actually, I have a question for Shannon because he's so much more familiar than I am with the OVEC plants. But it's my understanding that some of the coal burners involved in the OVEC plants, for decades on end, every watt of electricity they generated went to really air condition the uranium enrichment facilities at places like Paducah, Kentucky. And what was so objectionable about that, besides, you know, the fact that it, you know, partially fueled the arms arsenal, the nuclear weapons arsenal, was also just the emissions from places like Paducah, Kentucky, the chlorofluorocarbons that ate a hole in the ozone layer. It was some incredible figure like, boy, first of all, it was 1% of electricity consumption in the United States. That's how electricity intensive the uranium enrichment was, the gaseous diffusion. But it also used 14% of the world's chlorofluorocarbon 114, which was an ozone destroyer. I think it was, boy, it was like 80-some percent of the U.S. emissions of the CFC. So that's another very shady chapter in the history of the OVEC plant.
Right. Yes, I mean, certainly I know the Kiger Creek plant, which is one of the two OVEC plants, that was actually built initially to provide power to the gaseous diffusion plant in Piketon, Ohio. And I believe it did that up till about 2003. Since then, Kiger Creek now is producing electricity, goes into the grid and serves, residential, commercial, industrial electric needs. But yeah, you've got dirty coal fueling and dangerous nuclear activity. So it was kind of a worst of both worlds.
Yeah.
Staggering. It's a staggering reality here. It's hard to believe that anybody could propose this and think that they're going to get away with it. But how do we stop it? I mean, you have the staff of the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio in the middle of the Paris talks to cut global warming, demanding billions of dollars from the ratepayers of Ohio to subsidize the unprofitable operation of coal-burning power plants that are between 40 and 60 years old. Is that a fair statement?
That is essentially what the backroom deal would do, would be to subsidize those plants for the next 8 years. How we stop it is, we, Earth Justice and Sierra Club, we've been litigating at the commission on this case for the past 15 months, and we remain hopeful that the commission itself will see through this proposal and will realize that it's bad for customers and it's not legal, and that the commission will turn it down. If they don't, there's plenty of routes for appeal to take. And the other thing is for your listeners to let their voice be heard, and there's public comment opportunities with the commission, with your elected officials, all who can weigh in on this and help make clear that this is something that's really unpopular. People don't want to be taking money out of their pocketbooks to bail out shareholders of First Energy. So people need to make sure that their commissioners and their elected officials realize that, and that we want a clean transition to a clean energy future, not locking ourselves into these dirty plants from the past.
Unbelievable. Where can people go? What website can people look at to see more about this rate case and about the Davis Bessie Nuke in particular?
Well, the rate case, all the filings, et cetera, are on the docket of the Public Utility Commission of Ohio. So there's information there. They can also, I believe, check out Sierra Club's website. I believe would have some information on it also about this proposal and what's wrong with it. Those would be two places to start.
Yeah,
and Kevin Camps, where do people...
At the top of our website, I'll put a link to lead to more information, and our website is just beyondnuclear.org.
Staggering. We're talking with Kevin and Shannon here about the bailout proposed in the last couple of days. It's not a backroom deal. It's a bathroom deal, between these two entities, the staff of the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio and the First Energy Nuclear Plant, First Energy Utility Company, privately owned, operating the Davis Vesey Nuke. And we have to put this in the larger context. This is going on all over the country. You have five reactors in Illinois where the owners have gone into the Illinois legislature and demanded huge bailouts. You just had a bailout written in for the Ginna nuclear plant in upstate New York. These atomic reactors cannot compete in the marketplace, even though they are fully amortized. They're completely paid for, but now it's just the operation and management costs of these old reactors is through the ceiling, and they're going hat in hand to the public to demand bailouts. And we've just shut two reactors in New England, or in the process of. Well, Vermont Yankee is shut, and then Plymouth, the Pilgrim reactor at Plymouth is heading in that direction for economic reasons, because they knew they couldn't get bailed out in New England. But here in Ohio and in Illinois and in upstate New York, they seem to think they're getting away with it. And this is going to be happening all over the country. 98 reactors, 99 in the country, and none of them are making money, or I guess some of them are, but they're not economically viable if all the costs are taken into consideration. And here we have plants that are just so far over the line, it's unbelievable to even think about this. But we're going to have to deal with it. I am in Ohio. I am not a ratepayer in the First Energy District, thank goodness. But people in Northern Ohio are going completely nuts over this, as you might imagine. Shannon, what do you think the chances are that you'll prevail in court against this scam that's being foisted on people of Ohio?
Well, the first step will be hopefully we will prevail in front of the commission, because the commission does not have to follow what the staff does. The commission is independent and can choose to reject the backroom deal. They can choose to modify it. So we're hopeful that they will do that. But if not, any party that's unhappy with their decision can take it to the Ohio Supreme Court. And I think we have, strong legal arguments that this proposal is simply not allowed by Ohio law. And there were 35 days of hearings in which we cross-examined company witnesses and presented our own testimony, and I think made a strong case there that this bailout would be bad for customers and not just and reasonable. So I feel good about the case we've made, and I look forward to hopefully convincing the commission to seeing it our way.
Well, if the commission goes the way of the utility company, is there a recourse in the civil courts?
Well, if the commission approves a proposal that we think is illegal, the appeal would be straight to the Ohio Supreme Court.
Uh-huh.
And then there's also separately there's been talk about potential federal court claims on that what's happening here is preempted by federal law.
Well, we can only hope. I mean, I'm not optimistic about the Roberts Scalia Court, but is there anything to be done by referendum?
This would be the Ohio Supreme Court, not the federal Supreme Court.
Well, one would assume that it would eventually get to the federal Supreme Court, or is that not? Is there no jurisdiction there?
Well, I guess if somebody brought it, yeah, the appeal from the commission's decision would go to the Ohio Supreme Court, and I guess it could go to the U.S. Supreme Court, but I think that's pretty unlikely. The federal preemption claim, that is something that is a separate potential proceeding that could, I guess, eventually end up in the U.S. Supreme Court. But that's a long ways off. I think the focus right now is that the commission should do its job, protect customers, and reject this proposal.
Oh, my God. Kevin, do you have anything further to say about this situation with David Stussy here? Kevin
Kamps. I was going to add something onto what you said about Exelon Nuclear. You mentioned the five reactors in Illinois that are on the brink of closure, like David Stussy, for being uncompetitive. So just yesterday, I attended hearings before the D.C. Public Service Commission, where Exelon Nuclear is trying to take over the Mid-Atlantic utility called TEPCO, which serves D.C. and Maryland and parts of Virginia and Delaware. And what's going on there is Exelon would just love to get its hands on this regulated utility, TEPCO, so that it can increase rates by something like 45% in the year 2019 in hopes of funneling that money back to Illinois to prop up the reactors. And in addition to that, Exelon is going to try to, you know, eventually sabotage renewable energy and energy efficiency in the Mid-Atlantic region because it's the competition against its nuclear fleet. So the Public Service Commission made the right decision at the end of August and said, no way, it's not in the public interest. And then yet again, another backroom deal, the mayor of D.C. got together with Exelon's lobbyists and came out with a settlement agreement. So all of a sudden, it's back at the Public Service Commission on an expedited basis. That's what started yesterday. The public has till December 18th to comment, and it's just incredible. I mean, it's so ironic. Washington, D.C. got an award at the Paris gathering today for its sustainable energy plan for the future. Well, they're about to hand over that sustainable energy plan to the only company ever kicked out of the American Wind Energy Association, Exelon, which was lobbying against wind power production tax credits at the federal level, while taking them at its wind division in Illinois.
Oh, my God. There's just no shame. There's no end to these guys. It's devastating. I remember very clearly, being Columbus, of course, about a decade ago, there was this big argument in the state, and the utility companies came in, and they said they wanted to deregulate the market so that they could have competition. And that people would be able to choose their electric supplier, which everybody knew was utter horseshit. I mean, just ridiculous. And how they came in and said this with a straight face is beyond me. They're going to have competition in the electric power business. It's like competition in streets. And the Ohio legislature, which we refer to as the Night of the Living Dead, just rolled over and gave the utility companies almost in the vicinity of $10 billion to refurbish the nukes, because they referred to the nukes, there are two reactors in Ohio, Perry and David Stussy, as stranded costs. And they said because they're old and blah, blah, whatever, they couldn't compete. They had to be brought up to snuff so they can compete in this great, wonderful open market that was going to arise. And then the utility company executives pocketed the money, did nothing really to upgrade the reactors. And now, a decade later, wouldn't you know, what a surprise, they're coming in and saying, well, we can't compete now, so we need to not be regulated, not have a deregulated market. Now we have to basically find a way around deregulation, get regulated again, so that we can set a rate to force the ratepayers to pay to subsidize these ridiculous coal and nuclear burners. I mean, it is just beyond anything rational or sane that you could even think of. So, Shannon, how do we proceed now? You are hired by the Sierra Club, which is, are you hired by the National, the Ohio, and what are you going to be doing now?
Well, we represent the Sierra Club, National Sierra Club, in this proceeding, and we're actually a nonprofit organization, so we all of our time is free. We rely on donations rather than charging our clients. But our next steps are we are seeking to do discovery and to submit our own testimony in response to this backroom deal that was announced on Tuesday, and then there will be presumably there will be a hearing in front of the attorney examiner for the commission, where we'll get to question their witnesses, they'll get to question our witnesses, and then the lawyers will write their briefs, and then it will go up to the commission, and the commission will have to make its decision, and we hope they will make the right one.
Well, let me, here you go. Kevin, I think you testified. They held hearings. The Public Utility Commission held a series of public hearings in Ohio, all over the state, to get citizen input on this request from First Energy to bail out their nuke. Is there any indication that the staff of the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio listened to anything the public said, or was it a total useless, insulting scam that they put on to hold these hearings? Kevin, what do you think?
I took part in the Akron hearings. That was January of 2015, and I took part in the Toledo hearings in January of 2015. And especially in Akron, I was really just horrified to listen to some of the folks who testified who said, if my electricity bill goes up again, I'm going to be homeless. You know, this was young people, people of color. ARP was there testifying against these rate hikes. This is, you know,
America,
real world stuff for people who are going to be driven out of their homes because they can't afford to pay their electricity bill.
And now they're going to raise the rates. Davis Bessie, to keep this ridiculous nuclear plant going and these coal burners contributing to global warming, climate chaos, these people's rates are going to go up, right?
The deal, even using First Energy's overly rosy numbers, projects that they would, rates for customers would increase by $414 million in the first 31 months. And then after that, First Energy claims that the deal will somehow be profitable for customers, but we believe more credible projections. So it will be a money loser, potentially up to $3.9 billion. On your point about the staff, the interesting thing was 2 months ago, the staff filed testimony in the First Energy proceeding urging the commission to reject First Energy's proposal. Saying that it was not supported by law and it was bad for ratepayers, bad for customers. And so this backroom deal that's been worked out is a very sudden turnaround compared to what the staff had testified to just a couple months ago. So, you know, we were certainly disappointed to see that, but we're not quite sure why the staff made that turnaround, but that's what's happened here.
You know, Harvey, I saw a really interesting kind of smoking gun sentence in the UBS coverage of this proposed deal. UBS is a Swiss investment bank, and they have an extensive, you know, clientele of energy investors. And UBS didn't see this deal as a bad thing. They thought, you know, First Energy's share price is going to go up. So they kind of were encouraging people to think about getting First Energy stocks if this thing goes through. And the line that just shocked me was they just kind of flippantly said, well, you know, Governor Kasich kind of said this should happen. So that's what's going on at the PUCO.
Oh, my God. Charles Komaroff, have you joined us yet?
Harvey, how you doing?
Charlie Komaroff, you're with us now, right?
I sure am.
Okay, and you're in New York City. So we've
that's
been talking
right.
with, I don't know how much you've heard, we've been talking with Shannon Fisk. Of Earth Justice, who's conducting a legal case for the Sierra Club of Ohio, and Kevin Camps of Beyond Nuclear, the great expert on the Davis Bessie reactor, and we're dealing with the, you know, it's like a bad acid trip, talking about what these guys are pulling off here. They are going to be gouging, or if the God forbid the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio goes along with this, they will be gouging upwards of $4 billion from Ohio ratepayers to subsidize the continued operation of coal burners that are between 40 and 60 years old And the David Spessy, how old is David Spessy, Kevin?
It's pushing 40 years old.
A 40-year-old nuclear plant, probably the most dangerous one in the world, given what is going on there. It is literally crumbling. They had acid through their shield vessel there, and the head has been cut into David Spessy three times. Is that right, Kevin?
they've breached the shield building four times over the decades, the most of any right. atomic reactor that our expert Arne Gunderson knows of.
You know, it is astonishing. Now, you, Charles Collins, and Shannon and Kevin, you're welcome to stay with us and listen in and comment whenever you like. But, Charlie, you and I have known each other a long time, and you are the world's expert, as far as I'm concerned, on the carbon tax. Now, we're having there's a major meeting in Paris, of course, a worldwide meeting, a global meeting in Paris to deal with climate chaos and carbon dioxide emissions. And I have just read, talking about bad acid, I have just read a truly psychedelic piece by Dr. James Hansen and some others, three other people, advocating building hundreds, and I mean hundreds, of nuclear power plants to so-called solve the global warming issue. I mean, you know, I am going to write a piece tonight called "Is Dr. James Hansen Secretly Anti-Nuclear?" I mean, you read this piece, he's talking about, 50, 60 reactors a year. It's staggering how out of touch these people are. You have been advocating a carbon tax, and you're great at it. And can you explain to us, please, what your solution is for the global warming problem and what a carbon tax actually does and would do?
Yeah, well, thanks, Harvey. You know, it's not so much that a carbon tax is the solution as that it would catalyze hundreds, millions, billions of actions, investments, societal changes, big and small, that would all go in the direction of getting off of fossil fuels and thus reducing carbon emissions. So it's kind of a frame changer, a rules changer, a level playing field creator that would set off all kinds of changes in the economic fabric and, I hope, the social and cultural fabric, and would kind of, you know, shame fossil fuels, you know, in the way that, say, the divestment campaign is trying to do, that it would just put a cost burden on fossil fuels, or rather shift onto the prices of fossil fuels, the costs that the burning of fossil fuels is imposing upon the earth and all creatures who live on it. So, you know, we still have to talk about, and it's great to talk about, the energy efficiency and the windmills and the solar panels and the urban revitalization and the transit and the bicycling and the reuse and the veneration of nature and sustainability that will embody the changes. But it's the carbon tax that will set them off.
Now, who would levy the carbon tax? State governments, local governments, the feds, the UN? I mean, where would the carbon tax reside? Who would collect the money? And who would set the level of the tax?
Yeah, well, you know, great question. Ideally, the carbon tax, it's got to be at the nation level, at the national level. And, you know, all power to activists in Washington state and a few other states who are working their tails off to get their states to enact carbon taxes as kind of a demonstration, you know, using the federal laboratory. What was that great phrase that Justice Brandeis had almost a century ago of, you know, the testing grounds of democracy being in the states? But it's got to be at a national level, because otherwise you get this whole beggar my neighbor thing, you know, where industries threaten to go over the state line. You know, so you can have modest carbon taxes in one state, but the value of that is to create a template for the United States to have a carbon tax, for Canada to have a carbon tax, for Brazil, China, India, Russia, you know, et cetera, to all have carbon taxes. And ideally, they would be at similar or the same levels. And we can talk about these border tax adjustments that would be kind of carbon tariffs that would help ensure that carbon taxes would be at roughly similar levels from country to country. But the great thing about national carbon taxes is that each country then gets to keep and use the carbon tax revenue in the way that its citizens, and I know I'm assuming that states are, that nation states are democracies, which is the exception rather than the rule, but it would be the national governments that would decide how to use the revenues. And that's a really key question, because if we don't use the revenues, if the revenues from carbon taxes are allowed to go into the pockets of the oligarchs and the super rich, then it's going to be yet another thing kicking the crap out of middle class and working class and poor people in this country and around the world. And that must not be allowed to happen.
And so, as Shannon and Kevin have explained, what's being proposed here in Ohio is a reverse carbon tax. They want to subsidize coal-burning power plants in this state. Are you seeing this elsewhere?
Actually, that's a well, yeah, Harvey. You know, in fact, in this week's New Yorker magazine, there's a good brief column called The Financial Page that lays out the fact that for, you know, decades, for actually, Harvey, the entire, you know, 40 years that you and I have known each other and kind of worked in tandem, our federal government, from Carter right through Obama, has been giving away our coal, the United States-owned coal, in the Powder River Basin in Wyoming and Montana, which is now accounts for 40% of all of the coal burned in the United States from that kind of one area in the Rocky Mountain West. They've practically been giving away our federally publicly owned coal to the coal companies at just fire sale rates. So, you know, that's another reverse carbon tax in its own way, a counterpart to what you guys have been talking about, where the Ohio so-called Public Utilities Commission is going to be making ratepayers subsidize the ongoing operation of coal burners in your state that are tearing a hole in pocketbooks and helping to wreck the climate.
Staggering. Now, there is a predecessor, or there has been a, let's just have cap and trade. When people think of trying to control carbon emissions, the two prospects that have come up have been the carbon tax of cap and trade. What has happened? What is cap and trade, and what's happened with it?
Oh, yeah. And you did have to ask that question. And I say that not like, oh, did you have to do that? But yes, you do. Because, you know, cap and trade is this failed and yet somehow, you know, attractive mechanism that not only the banksters have glommed onto, because it involves creating whole new markets and whole new obscure manipulable financial instruments to trade carbon emission permits. And of course, guess who's going to skim the profits off of that and, you know, gyrate the system in order to you know, to game it and grab money. But the so-called green groups, our, you know, ex-environmental friends at the big national environmental groups, they are all over cap and trade, because 25 years ago in the 1990 Clean Air Act amendments, a Republican president, you know, Bush 41, signed legislation that created a national sulfur cap and trade system, which actually, you know, worked pretty well. But, you know, scaling up from a sulfur control system to one for carbon is kind of like, you know, scaling up from, you know, a solo piano player to a full orchestra. It doesn't scale. And in 1990, we didn't have quite the predatory bankster industry that is all over or will be all over cap and trade if it were to be enacted. But, you know, the world is waking up to it. And just this week in Paris at that big UN climate summit, the OECD top energy guy said, you know, cap and trade in Europe has been a failure. It's not transparent. It doesn't create the clear price signal that's needed to drive clean energy investments. And it's time for the world to turn away from cap and trade to a carbon tax. So if the head of the UN Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, can say that, well, it's time for NRDC and EDF and the Sierra Club and the other big green groups to get off of the cap and trade horse and climb onto a carbon tax.
My understanding is that Al Gore was an advocate of cap and trade. Is that correct?
No, well, you know, not really. I mean, Al has kind of straddled, you know, the divide between cap and trade and carbon tax. And I think, kind of to be fair to him, he was trying to get the carbon price, which is a way of kind of encompassing cap and trade and carbon tax, because the cap and trade emission permits do create a kind of revealed or embedded carbon price. And so, I think Al Gore, you know, if he could have run the world, he would have run it with a carbon tax.
Well, that's nice to think about. We're talking with Charles Komenoff, one of the, if not the leading advocate of the carbon tax. Charlie, what is your website if people want to see your work?
It's carbontax.org. And Harvey, you know, one thing I do want to say, I mean, thank you for, calling me in effect, you know, the emperor of carbon tax advocacy. But let our listeners know that just this past Sunday, as the Paris UN summit was getting underway, that we at the Carbon Tax Center released a letter to the UN negotiators, the climate negotiators, signed by 32 really notable individuals, including 4 Nobel Prize winners, 3 former cabinet secretaries on both sides of the political divide. One of them was George Shultz, who held 3 cabinet posts under Nixon and was Reagan's Secretary of State. And then, you know, 25 other luminaries, tenured professors at Harvard and whatnot, signing a letter urging the nations and the negotiators at Paris to prioritize a carbon tax as the central policy element around which everything else that's going to save our climate and pull Earth back from the brink of disaster, that it has to focus on. And I'm happy to say, Harvey, we've been getting a lot of mileage from that with the New York Times and the Atlantic and Scientific American covering that, because there were some pretty big names signing that letter, and that's a nice push for carbon tax advocacy. So maybe I'm the kind of the guy in the back helping to, pull a few strings, but it's big guns like George Shultz and Nobel Prize winners George Stiglitz, who's well known on the left, Kenneth Arrow and Tom Schelling, who are just luminous figures in economics and Nobel Prize winners. So there's a lot of push for a carbon tax, and what's needed is a grassroots movement in this country. Or, you know, the grassroots movement that's kind of there, that the Keystone Pipeline fight, the successful Keystone Pipeline fight, stirred up, that the divestment campaign, that 350.org are building, they've now really got to turn their advocacy to a carbon tax and begin to crack this Republican wall of denial, and as crazy as it sounds, to get a congressional majority so that the next Congress can enact a U.S. carbon tax.
Well, that, of course, will turn on our next discussion of electronic vote rigging. I have no doubt that a fair
take of the American electorate would give us a pro-carbon tax Congress. But here in Ohio, where the majority of the people vote Democratic, we have a House of Representatives and a Senate in Columbus that are have supermajority Republicans. How you get that in a Democratic state will be the subject of many more shows. Believe me. Well, with Charles Komenoff,
good thing. Yeah,
Charles Komenoff. Of course, you've now reached the pinnacle of the media chain here, getting on the Solartopia show. So we're really glad to have you. The carbon tax advocate was still. I don't know, Kevin. Camps, are you still with us from Beyond Nuclear? And Shannon,
yes,
Fisk
I am.
From, oh, good. And Shannon, are you still with us?
I am.
Oh, you are. Okay. So here's another. Here's the $64 trillion question for the Solartopia show. And Charlie, I am a total advocate of the carbon tax, and as I'm sure Kevin is, and I'm going to assume Shannon is, being with the Sierra Club or working for the Sierra Club. Where does nuclear power fit into this? We have now seen.
I knew that was coming. Boy, Harvey, you're just like the best interlocutor there could ever be.
There you go.
So we have.
I don't know. Let me ask you, Charlie, if James Hansen has signed on to your carbon tax advocacy, and has he? Do you know Dr. James Hansen?
Sorry, you're asking me if I know Jim?
Well, did he sign on to your?
Jim, you know, every once in a while, you know, a few times a year, he'll email me with some question, you know, like, if you had a carbon tax of X amount, how much carbon would that eliminate and how much revenue, you know. So I kind of answer some of his technical questions. We kind of have agreed to not talk about nuclear power.
okay.
You know, it's just like the relationship works better that way. We did not ask, the carbon tax and didn't ask Jim Hansen, nor did we ask Al Gore, frankly, to sign on to our carbon tax letter that we just released last weekend. We wanted to get people who were kind of not lightning rods and not seen as kind of overtly political, and maybe that sounds weaselly, but you know, when you're trying to get Nobel laureates and former cabinet secretaries and, you know, people kind of at that level, you kind of have to tiptoe a little bit, and it just seemed better to get folks who, you know, kind of were less politically polarizing. God, it almost pains me to say that. But anyway, that's what we did. But the question you're really asking me, Harvey, here's the answer. That a carbon tax, such as the one that the Carbon Tax Center advocates, would create a certain measure of advantage, competitive advantage, for nukes. Because
okay,
nuclear
so that,
power
that,
plants...
Charlie,
you
know, I know that.
I'm sorry. I thought that's kind of where you were leading. Yeah.
No,
I'm just trying to be candid.
We know that.
Yeah.
Go ahead. But the reality is that carbon, you know, there is a nuke chain of fuel processing and enrichment and mining, milling, and then, of course, managing of nuclear waste that does involve carbon. And also, and Kevin, I want to ask you this. There is a small amount of carbon that is actually emitted in the nuclear process. It's not carbon in the fission process. It's not
carbon-14?
Carbon-14, correct.
Right.
Yeah.
So, yeah,
carbon-14,
ironically enough, is perhaps the most biologically hazardous of the radionuclides because it goes anywhere in biology that carbon goes, which is pretty much everywhere.
Yeah.
And it has a half-life of 5,500 years, so you got to multiply by 10 or 20 to get the hazardous persistence. So you're looking at 55,000 to 110,000 years of hazard, and it's going to get out. I mean, the irradiated nuclear fuel rods are going to eventually fail, let out their gases and their volatile particulates. And so that carbon-14, if buried at Yucca Mountain, Nevada, for example, would leak massively into the atmosphere, would blow downwind, would incorporate into the food chain. So there is that. It's not at the, you know, the quantitative levels of coal-burning power plants releasing carbon dioxide, but it's going to have a significant biological impact downwind. In fact, if the generic repository standards were applied at Yucca, which they are exempted from, it would be disqualified because of the carbon-14 gas releases. And so one of the changes to the Nuclear Waste Policy Act back in 1992, the amendments, took away those generic standards at Yucca and called for site-specific standards. So that's been the history of Yucca, are these double standard standards. If it can't meet the standards, then the standards are changed or eliminated.
Well, Joe, let me ask you, and really I don't know the answer to this question. I'm not being a lawyer asking a question, I know the answer. Does the carbon tax apply to carbon-14 coming from nuclear reactors?
No. It applies only to the carbon that would be converted more or less automatically through the combustion process into carbon dioxide. And yes, to the extent that, I mean, Kevin, what's the number? Is it like that one out of every million CO2 atoms, CO2 molecules, you know, emitted, you know, from, actually, sorry, I was getting it backwards. I was thinking about what's going from a coal smokestack. The answer is no. But I think Kevin would agree that it is such a minuscule quantity, you know, the amount of CO2 that would be emitted from a nuclear reactor smokestack, that that omission is pretty irrelevant in the pantheon of the various forms of damages that nukes create to the biosphere.
Yeah, I you know, it is a small quantity of carbon. I mean, nuclear power in that sense is a low carbon greenhouse gas emitter. But some pushback, even on that point, would be things like the forever management of high-level radioactive waste, because really sweeping it under the rug at a place like Yucca Mountain, Nevada, isn't appropriate or responsible. And one calculation that comes to mind is Dr. Mark Cooper of Vermont Law School, who for the first time, to my knowledge, looked at what is it going to cost to manage high-level radioactive waste for the next couple hundred years? And the figure he came up with was...
That'll be an astronomical cost, there's no doubt. The question with Charlie is, is there a carbon emission cost? And, you know,
But I think what Kevin was going to get to, if I can say, is that those dollars that Mark Cooper from Vermont, you know, calculated have associated with them energy costs that if the energy were being generated by burning fossil fuels, you know, would have carbon consequences. And so that has to be counted. And, you know, that's certainly true. I think the thing that we all can kind of come together on is that the competition at this point, the things to replace coal as well as oil and gas, it's renewables versus nukes, and that renewables are going to win hands down in any fair level playing field competition of that sort. And, you know, Harvey, I'm saying that with a lot of conviction. I wasn't saying that half a dozen years ago. I've been really floored and encouraged and amazed by the cost progress. And I know, you know, people, probably you were saying this, and I just wasn't really, you know, paying enough attention. But also we had to see the evidence. And here it is, that the cost curves, especially from solar panels, but also from wind, just those cost curves are, we're coming down, down, and down them. And I don't think that renewables have much to fear in a fair competition with nukes.
Yes, and the problem is we don't have a fair competition with nukes, as we talked about in Ohio. Unfortunately, with these three great guys, we are out of time. Charlie Komenoff, your website is carbontax.org.
Yep.
Kevin Camps, nukefree.org.
It's beyondnuclear.org.
Beyond Nuclear. I'm
beyondnuclear.org.
My website is nukefree.org. And Shannon Fisk, where we'll get you?
And earthjustice.org.
All right. Well, listen, you three guys have been fabulous. We'll have you back on again another time, maybe next year, and not in Paris, but somewhere where next year in Toledo, when we're going completely nuclear
next year
and
in
non-nuclear.
Toledo. Yeah, that sounds good. Yeah.
Next year where marijuana has been legalized, by the way. Toledo, we have nuclear power, but they have decriminalized pot. By referendum in Toledo. So even Toledo, there is hope. This has been another Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Thank you again to the crew in New York. thank you. My fabulous guests will be back again to talk about how to get to a green-powered Earth, a socially just Earth. Next week, we're actually going to talk about women's rights and Planned Parenthood. So thank you again, everyone. We will see you soon, we hope, in Solartopia.
Okay, so long, Hug.
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found.